Welcome, Capital Raisers. I absolutely love hanging out with syndication attorneys. And today I got to spend time with the great one, Stacy Bowers. Was a ton of fun. And I know this may be overwhelming to new syndicators, but you need to get educated on capital raising law. If you don't know what to ask an attorney, tune into this one. We made it fun, educational, and digestible. If you'd like to explore partnerships with me, talk shop on capital raising, or hire me as a coach, use the scheduling link in the show notes. With that, it's Capital Raisers Show, episode 260, and it starts now. Rock and roll, I got Stacy Bowers on the Capital Raisers Show, my friend from Mike Morawski's event just a few months ago, back in October, the Multifamily Summit. And I'm really excited to have her on. We do not have enough syndication attorneys on, so I'm sure we're going to have a very cool conversation about all kinds of stuff, everything real estate syndication and capital raising. Capital Raiser Show Season 3 now brought to you by Pitch Decks, my friends at Richard Wilson's Family Office Club. Stacy, how are you doing? Welcome to the show. So excited to have you here.
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me. How are you today?
Yeah, I'm fantastic. 2023 is off to a great start. I've been reading a whole bunch of Napoleon Hill and Joe Dispenza, and we got a lot of stuff cooking in the build-to-rent space, so I'm really excited about 2023. My wife and I are getting along very well, so no complaints anywhere across the board.
Fantastic.
Right? How about yourself, Stacy? What have you been up to?
Just gearing up for 2023, enjoying trying to get outside when there's not too much snow on the ground. And supposedly we have another 10 inches of snow coming tonight. So we'll see what happens.
Where are you located?
I'm in Denver, Colorado.
Okay. What part of Denver? Just out of curiosity.
I live in a suburb called Park Hill. So I'm about 4 or 5 miles just directly east of downtown Denver.
East. Okay. My sister lives in Westminster.
Oh, so she's going to be north. She's going to be north.
She's like northwest. And that, so I go snowboarding a couple times a year.
Where do you go?
So all over the place. My favorite is, it's called Big Sky up in Montana, but I've been to A-Basin and Keystone, Durango, Telluride. And then what else? I think there's like one or two other places that are closer. Powderhorn, but in the Denver area, I think like one or other two places that I'm missing off the top of my head.
Got to get up to Steamboat Springs.
I've heard amazing things about them.
One of my favorite places.
What is your favorite place, just out of curiosity?
I love to travel generally, but Steamboat Springs. I spend my summers up there, and I can't ask for like a more beautiful place to spend summers.
So you mentioned before the show that you have a secondary home. Is that where it is?
Yep, we have a small condo in Steamboat Springs.
How lucky. Okay, cool. Let's dive into some syndication stuff. What is your favorite thing to talk about when you go on to podcasts, presentations? I'm sure raising money is a big part of it, correct?
Right. Raising money. And generally, I think probably what I talk about the most is just helping syndicators understand the role that lawyers should play. And then just the different sort of exemptions that are available for syndicators to raise capital and those type of things.
From your perspective, what is the syndication lawyer's role?
I think a good syndication lawyer plays a couple of roles. I think, first of all, we're there to be the lawyer and make sure the syndicator is complying with the securities laws, both at the federal level and the state level. But I also think part of our role is education and helping them understand the process and understand. A lot of times with first-time syndicators, they get into a waterfall and they have this idea of how they want to structure their waterfall, but they don't quite know how to put that in words or what that means. And so I think part of being a good syndicator lawyer is being able to help clients understand those kind of things without interfering in their business model, but lending some guidance and being able to talk through those kind of things as well.
So that's kind of the direction that I wanted to go is business, because I've run across a couple of people that are not lawyers, but work closely with lawyers, and they're either CPAs, but they refer to themselves oftentimes as fund architecture consultants. So people that will kind of dissect your business and let you know if it even makes sense to do a syndication or start a fund and kind of tell you, this is the way that you set it up. So this is how you get paid. This is how you set up all of these things. And then they basically turn it over to a lawyer, because the lawyer isn't always somebody that is the best person to give the business advice, but occasionally they do. So my next question to you is, do you give business advice in addition to legal advice?
from a lawyer perspective, I'll put on my little legal hat now and say, you know, lawyers are supposed to give legal advice. We're not necessarily supposed to give business advice. And I think to your point, what you're talking about with those, I think you call them fund architects or something like that.
Fund architects, that'll work. Fund architecture consultants.
I think that's an intriguing, role. And I'm glad to hear those people are out there. But at the end of the day, the lawyers are predominantly going to be drafting your private placement memorandum, making sure you're complying with the securities laws and able to step in and offer some advice here and there. I think some syndicator lawyers, because they themselves have done syndications and have more experience in that realm, I think sometimes they'll give a little bit more legal advice. But at the end of the day, we're supposed to be lawyers and we're supposed to focus on the legal advice.
Okay. So do you set up a lot of funds? Is it mostly one-off syndications? Do you do a combination of both?
I do a combination of both. So definitely a lot of just single asset purchases and then some real estate funds. Our firm does some fund-to-fund model work as well. So a little bit of everything.
Let's dive into the fund-to-fund models because—
Oh no, you're gonna take me down a path that I feel like you need one of my other colleagues.
For a little bit, if it's not your strength, everybody's got their own strengths. There's a lot of confusion around fund-to-funds and even within lawyers. You even mentioned yourself, hey, maybe one of my colleagues would be better to speak about fund-to-funds. But let me kind of break down some of the stuff that I've heard from different fund managers and, or I should say syndication attorneys.
Okay.
Because one time I was asking this fund manager, I'm like, this is like in my early days when I was trying to figure out if I should start a fund or not. I was like, hey, if I start a fund, I didn't really have clarity around it because I knew from my show that I had a lot of capital raiser, co-GP type people that were interested in working with me. I'm like, can I start a fund and get capital raiser co-GP partners that have databases of investors that invest into my fund and then my fund invest into deals? And somebody told me, Ike Mutabana told me, he's like, you want to be careful about the number of layers between the actual sponsor and the end LP, the limited partner. And I brought this up with another syndication attorney. And he's like, I don't see any problem with having multiple layers, particularly if you have a very large, like $1 billion capital raise. You're going to need to have a lot of people raising for this. And if there's multiple layers, that's fine. So I've heard different things. Do you have a take on this? Or is this something that you want to kind of dive into a little bit or no?
I think I can talk about it a little bit. I don't know how deep I want to go because I would have done more research if I'd known this was coming. I think part of the concern whenever you get into the fund model is there are two acts out there. They're called the Investment Advisors Act and the Investment Company Act. And whenever you start to create a very large fund and that fund is investing in other deals, and so it's not directly investing into real estate. So really what it's doing, it's investing into securities. And you always have to be cognizant of the fact that when you have that type of fund, you're stepping into the territory that, first of all, that fund could be deemed to be an investment company. And there's a whole parameter, there's a whole other set of rules and regulations that apply to investment companies. The other issue that the GP or the manager or the sponsor has to be cognizant of is, could they trip up and could the SEC come back and say, hey, you're an investment advisor? Because what you're really doing is you're taking $1 billion from all of these other investors, and essentially you're going to take their money and make investment decisions for them, which makes you look like an investment advisor. So my caution always is when we get into this arena of funds, we have to be cognizant of, can we find one of the exemptions that allows a syndicator to go down that path, and just being cognizant of those other acts. So it could have been that the one attorney you were speaking to that said, I don't see any problem here, in their mind, they might have been thinking, well, you're just going to register as an investment advisor. You're going to become an investment company. And in that scenario, I would agree with that lawyer. I don't think there's not as much concern there because you're complying with those other acts. But I would also say at the end of the day, I would caution most syndicators, they don't really want to have to comply with the 40 acts. They're a pain in the butt. There are a lot of rules and regulations. They're better off that's where a good syndicator lawyer, talk with them, figure out, is my structure going to work? If I do it this way, what do I need to be aware of? And it's much easier, for instance, like if you've got a fund that's investing directly in real estate. So they're actually the fund, instead of investing in other deals, the fund is raising money and it's going to go out and buy different pieces of real estate. So for instance, maybe you get a fund that wants to be a multifamily fund. So it raises a couple million dollars, and then it uses that money and it goes out there and buys three or four different properties. So now you have a real estate fund and there's an exemption for that. So when the fund is directly investing in real estate, it's not investing in a security. So that changes things up a bit. Whereas if you have a fund that's raising a couple million dollars or a billion to your point, and is going out there and looking to invest in different syndications and buying those securities, now you're investing in securities and you're starting to step into that territory of, okay, I need to understand, do the 40 Acts apply to me or not?
In what situation do you think it would make sense for a syndicator to go out? I know that you're not an advisor in this particular arena, but when it comes to going out and getting a securities license, when does it make sense for a syndicator to do that if they're raising capital?
Well, I don't know that I have the right answer to that question, but I guess my gut instinct would say, so I'm speaking gut instinct without research. I feel like I should say that as a lawyer.
That's cool.
If you're heading into that territory where you really do want to create a large fund and you want to have more discretion about how the monies in that fund are being deployed, I think that's the point you need to start thinking about. Do I need to start? Am I an investment advisor? Do I need to secure some licenses? And so I think as you get bigger and grow, those are probably conversations to start having with lawyers and understanding what's the best place for me to fit into this mix.
Yeah, I think we're going to be talking about that a lot on season three. I've interviewed some people that have gone their capital raise and they've gone out and got licenses because they want to be very tight. And so it gives them a level of credibility when they're licensed. But in addition to that, everything is buttoned up. And some people, it's particularly like the engineer analytical type person, they like to have everything buttoned up anyway. So why not get the license? And then, but there's some drawbacks that I see, which is now you have to hang your license with the broker and do what that broker wants you to do. So, but there's gives and takes. So I kind of get it. I'm trying to learn a little bit more about why people are doing it. I'm considering it myself. Okay. A little bit. I don't know if I want to do it. I like raising capital in funds and through regular syndications using the exemption. Speaking of exemptions, I think everybody or a lot of people know 506B, but there's other ones. There's the cash flow, the Reg A. Are you versed in talking about some of the different exemptions and why they exist?
I can definitely speak to like crowdfunding, the three exemptions under Reg D, which are, as you mentioned, 504, 506B, 506C. I can talk a little bit about Reg A, and it's really, most lawyers call it Reg A plus with the modifications that were made a number of years ago. I can touch the surface there a little bit more, but I know enough to have a conversation about Reg A plus.
So with Reg A plus, I believe you can raise larger amounts and have smaller per person raises and still make financial sense. So I believe Grant Cardone uses Regulation A plus where he can raise $500 or $1,000 at a time from people. And I understand the Regulation CF to be the same thing, but I'm probably missing something. What are the differences, do you know, between Reg A and Regulation Crowdfunding?
Actually, there's a pretty significant difference. So Reg A plus definitely larger dollar amounts that you can raise. But the other thing I would say is you can raise as much money as you want under a 506C. You could raise $1 billion under a 506C offering, and you could take $1 million from one single accredited investor in 506C. Reg A plus, and it's really referred to as a small public offering. So in essence, if you're doing a Reg A plus offering, you're doing a small public offering. And so the advantage to that is many times that security, whatever the form of that security is, might be listed and more easily tradable. So that's kind of one of the upsides of Reg A plus, is that you're creating a class of equity that might be easier to trade and change hands. But at the end of the day, there are downsides to Reg A plus, because now you're filing annual reports with the Securities and Exchange Commission. So in essence, under Reg A plus, you start to look more like a small public company, and you're going to have more of those obligations that sit on top of you. I think it does open up the parameters of maybe those passive investors, giving them a means to sell their security off a little bit easier than you can do in a 506B or C. On the other hand, crowdfunding, I think crowdfunding's tough in the syndication arena because there's such a small amount of money. So you can raise $5 million under a crowdfund. And there are extreme limits. It's really easy to bring in non-accredited investors, but they can't invest very much. And you can bring in accredited investors to a crowdfund. So what's the upside? I think probably a little faster, Everything gets done on what's called a portal. So in a crowdfunding, everything has to be done online. And that's an interesting aspect as well. But I will say the portal operators, the intermediaries that run the crowdfund for the issuer, they take a nice chunk of a percentage off the capital raise off the top. So I think crowdfunding, maybe that very first syndication, or you're doing something small, maybe you want to buy a house and fix and flip. That might be a place where it might make sense to do a crowdfund. But I think when you get into bigger assets, self-storage, multifamily, I think crowdfunding, there's not a lot of sense. I have seen clients use it kind of in conjunction with other offerings because it's a way to bring in what we think of as friends and family, those people that aren't accredited, but the amount of money that they can contribute to the capital as non-accredited investors in a crowdfund is pretty minimal. Whereas in a 506B, where you can bring in non-accredited investors, there's no limit on how much money they can contribute to the offering.
How about we go in the direction of why would a syndicator want to start a fund from your perspective?
So I'm seeing it with someone I'm working with right now is that doing these single asset syndications, no matter what the asset is, it can be time consuming. You're constantly working, you're with the bank, and sort of that as things start to dovetail and the bank needs this and you're trying to raise capital. And I think sometimes managing all of that process can be what all seems to come together at once. Whereas I think if you start a fund, so for instance, if you start a real estate fund and say, I'm going to raise money and I'm going to invest in this particular class of real estate, you've already got the money there from you. You've got the capital there. So now you can be working with the bank. You can get everything lined up with the bank, and then you source that capital or pull that capital for that particular deal. So I think it can make things a little bit easier. I think also as syndicators grow and they have a broader investor base, doing a fund is often a good way to do it. They've got their investors, they pull the money in and they say, okay, we're going to create a fund and we're going to go out there and buy 3 or 4 multifamily properties with the money in this fund. And then we're going to shut it down and go to the next one. It can save some money from a syndicator's point of view because you create a fund and you do a couple of deals within it as opposed to doing just one-off deals. And I think not just money, but I think sort of time. I think it can save some time and effort for the syndicator as well. But I think you want, as advice I would say to a syndicator, you want to have a good pool of investors before you start thinking about doing it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I love that last point because I think that there are some syndication attorneys that will take a person's money to create documents without even knowing if they can actually raise. Because some people have the unusual mindset that, oh, I'll just start a fund and the money will just be magically there, but they don't do all the marketing and they don't think and contemplate that they actually have to raise the capital just the same as even if it was a regular syndication. All right. So I want to add a couple of points too, because I think some people want to start a fund for a couple of reasons. One of them being they want to diversify into multiple assets and multiple markets with multiple sponsors. And diversification is kind of like a smoothening out of the roller coaster where an LP might have a really big return on one deal with one sponsor and then a smaller return with the same sponsor. And they kind of are just like, wait a second, I made 45% on this last one and now only 20 on this one. What's the deal? And then when you put all of the assets in one particular vehicle, then it kind of smooths out and the whole thing performs really well. The other thing that I would say too is I think some people start a fund even like as their first capital raise, and they do it because they can bring in their partners, make them part owners of the fund, and then together they can provide $1 million check and then get access to some of the sponsors that won't be interested in working with somebody that can only bring $250,000.
That's true. And I would tag on to that sometimes, especially if it's a fund that's investing into another deal versus buying real estate itself, like the fund to fund model. I think absolutely in that scenario, the fund can often come in and get a better return for its investors because it's bringing $1 million or $2 million to the table.
Okay. And then what are the different fund structures? Let me see. I'm going to list off a couple, right? There's a regular syndication, which is also known as a fund, but some people don't understand that. Then there is a blind pool fund. There is a semi-specific fund, which may be like a portfolio syndication where there's multiple assets in one syndication. And then there's this thing that I've heard multiple lawyers refer to in different ways, Some of them refer to it as a super fund. Some of it referred to as a deal by deal specified fund, where there's one master LLC, and each time you buy an asset, there's a new syndication that owns that asset, and all of these different syndications are owned by one master syndication, which has the effect of lowering the price of per syndication documents. And it's not specifically, I think one lawyer said, oh, the only reason that you would do that is to save money. What are some of the fund structures that you're familiar with? Are all of these ringing a bell, or have you not heard of some of these?
No, I've heard of all of them. And when you say blind pool as a lawyer, my stomach clenches because I think that's when you're really going to start bumping up against the 40 acts when you've got a blind pool. I think probably the most typical funds that we see and we work with. So the fund to fund model. Somebody creates a fund because they want to raise more money to be able to go in and be a higher value passive investor into another deal. So that fund to fund model, and that can be a really good thing for the investors into the fund because they get a better return than they could get if they just invested into that other syndication themselves. I think the other thing we see, and I forget what you called it, it's kind of the idea of you might have a real estate fund that says, I'm just investing in one particular asset. So I'm going to raise a bunch of money. I'm going to go out there and find 4, 5, 6 multifamily assets. Generally, in that scenario, we're going to encourage the client, in order to protect themselves from the 40 Act, be very specific. These are the kind of assets that I'm looking at. This is the class of asset, all the different parameters that you're looking for when you're out there for that asset. So the more specific you can be, the more it looks like you're not an investment advisor, because your passive investors are coming in and they can see how their money is going to be deployed, and they're making their own decision whether they want to invest in this fund, knowing it's going to go out there, invest in maybe 3 or 4 different kinds of property. I have seen the other fund you're talking about. So you create sort of this big fund, and then within that fund, sort of that, I would call it sort of the lead fund party. They go out and they maybe do 3 or 4 different deals. And on each of those deals, they bring in another co-GP, but it can be a different co-GP on each of those deals. I think maybe that's what you were talking about with the super fund. I can't remember, but I have seen that in action. And I do think it can work. I think it allows the sort of main party in the fund to be able to go out there and do a number of very large deals, bring in co-GPs. So the co-GP is bringing some capital to the table at the same time the main fund is, and then they're creating their own relationship around just one particular asset. And again, I think to the point, if you create sort of that big fund, you're only doing one offering and you've got money out there. The other thing I've seen funds do and clients ask for, and I'm going to say it's not as easy or uncomplicated as clients think, is this idea of creating a fund. And then the fund manager is going to go out there and look for particular investments. And then when they find something good, they're going to come back and ask their investors, do you want to be a part of this
deal? Yes, they have the choice.
Yes. And I think I understand the syndicator side, why they want to do that. But I would caution every syndicator, the back end administration on that kind of fund is really incredible, because basically, okay, I have these 10 investors in this one deal, and then I have another 20 over here, but some of them are in that first deal and some are in the fourth deal. Mm-hmm. And so trying to track that waterfall structure that pertains to each particular deal, it's really like doing, let's say they do 4. It's like doing 4 single asset syndications, but you're trying to lump it all together. And again, I understand why syndicators are intrigued by that, but I don't think it's as easy as they think it is. Whereas if you do a big fund and just say, okay, here's the parameters about what we're going to invest in, and you're going to get the same return no matter what we invest in, here's the return structure, I think that's pretty easy to manage from a fund perspective.
Yeah, that's why there's some fund administration companies that are making a whole bunch of money off syndicators, managing all of the K-1s and mm-hmm. managing which deals and which investors are going into all of that stuff. So talk to Baudry at Avestor or some of his competitors. And so one thing that I wanted to mention too for the audience is, because different attorneys will give you different advice and use different vocabulary, I always recommend, if you're listening in because you're curious about, you want to scale into syndication and you want to understand what kind of conversations you need to have with a lawyer, please go out and talk to at least about 5 to 10 lawyers just to see who you resonate with, who you feel like you can understand and relate with the most, and how much each of them costs, because there's varying costs for all kinds of different products and services that the attorneys do. But just like when you're going and seeking somebody to raise capital for as a co-GP, you don't want to just go with the first one. You want to talk to about 10 sponsors, if not more, before you decide who makes best sense for you and your investor database.
I think you should interview your lawyer just like you would interview anyone else. I might dispute the 5 to 10. I think if a syndicator had to talk to 5 to 10 different lawyers, they'd lose their mind. I do think you ought to talk to at least 3 lawyers and interview them. Do you like them? Are you going to get along with them? What are their fees? Make sure they're completely upfront about what their fees look like. I think that's really important.
And if you're afraid to talk to a lawyer because you don't know what to ask, feel free to go back through the Capital Raiser Show archives. There's probably about 10 lawyers that I've interviewed, and I've asked them all pretty good questions. Even like at day one or the very beginning, I didn't even know what a K-1 was or what syndication was. So I was asking lawyers stupid questions. So they got more sophisticated as time went on. Let's talk a little bit about conditioning the market. What can you say in a 506C? What kind of mistakes are people making, and how much trouble can somebody really get into? Unless they're committing fraud, I don't think they're going to go to jail, but there's other ramifications, like maybe losing the ability to capital raise. From your perspective, let's start with what kind of trouble can people get into, and what are the things that they're doing to get into trouble?
I think probably the conversations I have most with clients trying to keep them out of trouble is understanding the difference between a B and C offering. No general solicitation or advertising in a B. And that's why you have to have that pre-existing substantive relationship. So the idea behind that, I think sometimes people don't put it together. By having a pre-existing substantive relationship, you're not engaged in general solicitation. So that's kind of tying those things together, because I think sometimes lawyers talk about them and they don't make that connection. With a 506C, you can general solicit, you can general advertise, but you do want to have a good faith belief that the people you're talking to are accredited investors. So not that you're going to get in trouble if you're out there general soliciting and advertising and somebody who happens to see your solicitation and advertisements is not accredited. But again, with a 506C, as those investors come in, you want to make sure they're accredited investors before you start sharing documents. And then with a C, they have to certify. They have to get usually their CPA or financial, their investment advisor is going to certify that they're accredited. So I think that's the biggest concern that I see. The other thing I see, you cannot earn a fee based on capital raised. No. Yeah. I cannot tell you how many syndicators come in and say, oh, we want to get 1% of the capital we raised, or we want to have this random third party help us raise capital, and we're going to give them a percentage of capital raised. So I think those are the biggest, a lot of the questions that we see of trying to rein syndicators in and try and help them understand some of those nuances of securities laws. Yeah. And what happens, you're absolutely right. The SEC can come back and say to you, guess what? You're now what we call a bad actor because you violated the federal securities laws. And you can't raise capital anymore. Not only can you not raise capital, but you can't even be a manager of an entity that's raising capital. And so the ramifications for running afoul of those rules can be pretty significant to somebody's career as a syndicator.
Good stuff. Okay. So you actually can get compensated, but you have to be licensed.
You're right. If you're a broker dealer, if you're a registered broker dealer, then the issuer could hire you as a registered broker dealer and you could be compensated for capital raising. But otherwise, this idea that I'm going to pay my kid I use that loosely to help me capital raise, and I'm going to give them 0.5% of whatever they raise, that's not okay.
Yeah. For those of you guys that have a database out there and you're thinking about capital raising, understand, I think the part that they have to have an ongoing duty is kind of clear, but maybe there's some fog in there, because when you do co-GP with somebody, you are in partnership with them until the day that that deal is sold. Absolutely. So it's not just, hey, I'm going to participate in some advisory board meetings. You actually have to have an ongoing duty and get paid based off of the full scope of the things that you're doing, not specifically the capital raise. So great point. Right. Let's go back to, and we're going to gear this specifically to 506C. We're not going to go over all the details of 506C, but what can you say if you're doing a 506C? Can I go on a podcast? Can I go in front of a stage and talk about the returns and the deals? Is that something that you advise against just because you should be safe? Tell me your perspective.
I'm going to give you my first perspective. I started my career at the Securities and Exchange Commission. So I'm probably awesome. I'm going to be a little more conservative than maybe some syndication lawyers. I do think you can talk on a podcast. I think you can be at sort of some kind of function where you're talking about your offering. If you're at a function or on a stage, I'd want to have a good feeling that most of the people in my audience were accredited investors. But at the end of the day, you can definitely be out there talking about it. You want to make sure you're always giving disclaimers. There's no guarantee. We can't assure you this is going to happen. I think you can share projections and estimates about what you think those returns will be.
Yes, no guarantees, guys.
No guarantees. And I get a lot of questions from clients like, can we talk about prior deals and how we did in prior deals? So I'm like, that's fine. You can talk about how a prior deal went, but anything you say better be 100% factual and you should be able to substantiate it. Disclaim, 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 CYA, however you want to think about it, but always being cautious. And I would say sometimes less is more, especially when you're out there talking more broadly. Now, when somebody comes back to you and says, hey, I heard you're doing this offering, you vet them to make sure they're an accredited investor, and then you share your offering deck and all of that kind of stuff because you know they're accredited investors coming into a 506C. But again, with your offering deck, you're going to have disclaimers and you're going to want to be careful about how you couch your returns.
Conditioning the market. Okay, so I get sometimes people come onto the show and they're doing 506Bs and they're under contract and they've already started some work. And they'll slip a little bit of like, oh yeah, we just put the sign up on this particular property and I'll determine that they're 506B and I'll have to delete like a whole section of the show because they're doing something that they're not supposed to be doing. I'm very diligent about that. I'm not saying come on my show and do that and have me edit that stuff out for you without regard. That's not cool. But be very careful, guys, that when you come onto a show, if you have a 506B, don't talk about it at all, guys. So from your perspective, conditioning the market, what are some of the slip-ups that people make?
In a C or a B?
So conditioning the market, I don't think it exists in a C, but in a B.
No, it doesn't. But in a B, I think the minute you, like you said, come on a podcast and talk about a 506B, so you've launched your offering, you can no longer create a pre-existing substantive relationship. And you've just engaged in general advertising and solicitation. So I would say at that point in time, you've screwed yourself on your 506B offering.
I get people that message me on LinkedIn and they're like, hey man, you got any 506B offerings? I'm like, well, even if I did, I have no pre-existing relationship with you. Like, I can't do anything with you. Like, why are you even asking me? I mean, I could start a relationship with you and maybe on the next one, right. But
exactly. And that's the trick. If you're doing 506Bs, keep a good database, keep records about how you've established your relationship.
Yes.
So as you start talking to those people, you have really good substantiation that I had a pre-existing relationship.
Guys, I know that there's a lot of you and ladies that are out networking and you're like driving your kids around and you're doing investor calls on the phone, on your cell phone while you're out in the city. You guys can't take notes if you guys are getting in the habit of doing this. So I recommend be in front of a computer, in front of ActiveCampaign, open up the notes tab, write exactly what you discussed with everybody. And then that's going to help you remember who these people are and what kind of stuff they like to do too, in addition to everything else that if a regulator comes knocking on your door, they're going to be like, you know, when did you meet this? And what conversations have you had? And if you have that right there and in your calendar, that helps quite a bit. I don't know how common that is, but I definitely want to make sure that if a regulator ever comes knocking on my door, that I got all my bases covered.
Well, I think regulators knock on your door. So it's one of those things when something goes wrong and somebody, I think an investor is upset. That's when a regulator is more likely to come knocking on your door, so to speak. I think that's just the nature of the world we live in. If things are going well in a syndication and people are making good returns, they're happy. But the minute something's not going quite how they want it, or maybe quite how it was explained to them, that's when those investors are more likely to pick up the phone and call a securities regulator.
Okay, so my friend Joel Block, who's one of these fund architecture consultants, he doesn't refer to himself as that, but that's essentially what he does. He helps people with creating funds and hedge funds and syndications and whatnot. He has his own symposium around hedge funds. And one of the things that he told me, I mentioned to you at Mike's Multifamily Global Summit, and you got a kick out of it, which is he was kind of creating this threatening situation where a regulator or FBI person comes to the door and says, "Hey, you know, Mr. Smith, that investor that's in your deal?" And you say, "Yeah." "Well, you're under arrest because that person has committed fraud and has been washing money and using your syndication to wash their money. You're under arrest." And you're just like, "Oh, that's so unrealistic. That'll never happen." Can you tell me what you recall from me giving that example to you? Is it really possible for the FBI to come up if you've taken some money from a criminal, and can you get in trouble for that?
Yeah, absolutely. In reality, the FBI could come knocking on your door because somebody who's engaged in criminal enterprise has invested money into your syndication. But hopefully, if you've done your legwork, if you're a B, you've had a pre-existing substantive relationship, you've had conversations, you've got some good notes. And I mean, at the end of the day, it's going to be like, did you have any reason to know this person was a criminal? If for some reason you think someone's a criminal, don't take their money. You as a syndicator can always tell somebody you're not taking their investment. That's your right as a syndicator. So if you ever have even just an inkling of doubt about a potential investor, don't take their money. Like, just don't put yourself in that situation. But I think to your point, Ruben, I think it could happen, but hopefully you would be able to prove that you just had no idea that this person was a money launderer. And it would go away. Now, it's not to say that somehow the FBI is not going to try and recoup some of that money that that person put into your deal. But hopefully you yourself personally as the syndicator would not wind up in trouble. Now, if you knew, yeah, that's a different story. We're having a different conversation if you knew they were a money launderer.
Okay, cool. Because they practice the golden rule, guys. Just do unto others as you would want done unto yourself. One last topic before we jump into the lightning round. So I've heard about this situation where a 506B fund can invest into a 506C. And I believe the threshold is if you get $5 million in the B and you have a bunch of B investors, they can actually consider themselves accredited and allowed to go into the 506C. Is this the case? Have you heard of this? Can you break this down a little bit or no?
I've heard of this, but I will tell you, under the accredited investor definition, for a limited liability company to be considered to be accredited, every member of that company, every member of the LLC has to be accredited. So to your point, and I'm not aware of any exemption to that or that the SEC has come out and said differently, but with a limited liability company, I feel like they're conflating sort of two regulations that exist out there. The idea that if an LLC has $5 million, they might be accredited, but generally everyone in that LLC needs to be accredited as well. So I know people create 506B funds and they invest in a 506C fund. I think it's really risky. I think it's probably more risky for the 506C that's being invested into, because they're the ones that have to establish that all of their investors are accredited investors.
Yeah.
And so I actually think that that is the LLC that's probably more at risk versus the 506B fund itself. We do not recommend creating a 506B fund that's investing in other funds.
Cool. I'll have to explore.
And I know other people say differently. So again, to your point, different lawyers will give you different advice.
Awesome. Okay, cool. Let's jump into the lightning round. These are just going to be general questions. Let's start with this. What's the best vacation you've ever taken?
I don't know. I just went to Greece last year and it was absolutely amazing.
Okay, cool. Favorite book of any kind?
It's an old book called Fool on a Hill by Matt Ruff. It's a very, I don't even know, it's probably from the 80s.
Interesting. I'll have to check that out. What percentage of your success revolves around mindset?
A lot. I don't know that I can put a percentage on it, but I think mindset just makes a difference in everything we do.
How long do you want to live?
I'm happy to live a long time, as long as I can still be active.
What do you do to elevate yourself in terms of creating greater success?
I guess I would say I love learning. So I'm reading books, or I'm talking to people, or right now I'm reading, I think it's called Atomic Habits.
Oh, so I've been wanting to get that.
So yeah, I think reading and learning and always trying to expand my brain.
Okay, so Atomic Habits, that's the one where you just increase a little bit and then exponentially it grows. I have to go get that book.
Yeah, I'm only about 3 or 4 chapters in, but I'm definitely liking it.
Cool. Short answer on this, best way to raise capital from your perspective?
I think networking, going to events, meeting people. I think early syndicators creating really strong co-GP relationships with a GP that's more experienced and in the market and sort of can mentor you and help you down that path. I guess I think more than anything, like that's a really great piece of advice. Instead of doing your first deal on your own, find like a really strong co-GP co-GP with.
That's phenomenal advice. I love that. Don't try and connect with people at the same level as you. Find somebody that's got a track record and experience so that you can use their track record and they can leverage your skills that you bring to the table as well. How about this? What do you love best about being a syndication attorney?
All my career, I've been a lawyer for a lot of decades and I've worked in the capital raising space. I think it's just fun to see entrepreneurs raise capital and be successful.
And what do you love about trail running and hiking and being outdoors?
I love being in nature. I think just for me, just being outside makes me happy and puts me in a more, to your point, a more positive frame of mind. So I'm one of those people. I get really grumpy if I can't get outside, even if it's crazy weather. I need to like outdoor time.
Okay, 3 more questions. Do your spiritual philosophies have anything to do with your success in business?
No.
How about this? Have you ever experienced a miracle or had a near-death experience?
I have not on either.
Last question brought to you by Shanna Amigo, one of our great listeners. She would like to know what impact you would like to leave in the world.
I think that just that I'm a good person and I try and help people.
Rock and roll. Very cool answers on the lightning round. Thanks for entertaining us on that part of the show. Shout out to the Capital Raiser Nation. Thanks for tuning in. Please leave us a 5-star written review. Shout out to Legacy Acquisitions, my company, and our sponsors, Syndication Pro, Family Office Club, and PitchDecks.com. Check out their offers at the Capital Raiser Show website, capitalraisershow.com. Stacey, how does the audience get a hold of you?
Stacey Bowers. I work for 3 Pillars Law, which is a small firm outside of Denver in a town called Castle Rock. And I am just Stacey at 3pillarslaw.com.
Rock and roll. Make sure and reach out to her, ladies and gentlemen. All right. Last question of the day. Do you have any words of wisdom, any parting words of wisdom for the aspiring capital raiser and or syndicator as they're scaling on their journey?
Make good connections with other syndicators, with lawyers, with accountants. Don't do it on your own. There's a reason all of those people are out there, and take advantage of their skill set to supplement yours.
It's a team sport for sure. Very cool. This has been fun. I really appreciate you coming on. I love hanging out with attorneys. Thank you very much. I really appreciate this.
Thanks for having me.